Hello and welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to another installment of K-Chung Radio's own The Talking Show. I'm one of your hosts, Steve Cato.
And I am the other, Nicholas Miller.
That's right. You sure are Nicholas Miller.
That's right.
And today, I have to confess, things have gotten a little messed up.
To say the least.
Maybe since the second or third episode of The Talking Show, back in the dawn of history, we've been receiving calls from one guy who wanted so desperately to be a guest. You know, it's a radio show in Los Angeles. Two guys in Los Angeles making a radio show about talking. And this guy just wanted a piece so bad. And, you know, it's never really been our thing. We've had other stuff going on. We had our own ideas about who should or shouldn't be on the show, what the show should be like. But, you know, every couple weeks without fail, this guy would call. We'd hear from him.
Yeah, let's not forget all the emails.
Yeah, yeah.
Jeez.
You're right, Nicholas, yeah. I'll just name names here. I'm talking about Henry Rollins. Every couple weeks, Henry Rollins calls into the show, calls Lorna over the switchboard, and, you know, wants to let us know about some new stuff he's come up with, you know, just getting in touch, just wanted to see how we were doing, you know, but always sort of putting it in there that, you know, we're guys in Los Angeles, we do this talking thing, why don't we, you know, put him on the show sometime? And so, you know, we're in the fourth season now of The Talking Show, and we figured, sure, let's make room for Henry here. Let's get Hank on the air. We've been doing other stuff. We can make some room for Hank. And that was the plan today. So, you know, a few weeks ago, as our usual schedule works out, we emailed Henry, told him, you know, is this a good day for you? Worked it out. Yeah. Okay. You know, well, okay. So we'll put Kevin on that day and we'll la la la. Well, Henry will go over here. And then everything was going fine. We were going to have Henry Rollins in the studio today. Maybe he would finally leave us alone about being on this show. But about an hour and a half before we go to air, when he should have been here already, sound checking, working things out, we see, first of all, on his Twitter feed, he posted a picture of this meal he was about to eat. It was like a multi-course Chinese meal, and it was going to take at least 2 hours to eat based on the sort of look of the restaurant and all that other stuff. So that's the first warning sign. And then about half an hour ago, I get a text message from Henry saying, sorry, not able to make it. That's it. And so you can imagine the chaos here at K-Chung. Lorna goes gray practically. Solomon throws a shit fit in the hall.
We don't even want to say what Mr. Jungle Guts did. That dude went fucking nuts.
Yeah. That's right, Nicholas. Harry.
Out of control. I can barely keep it together.
The scene was Harry. Perfect. Perfect word for this.
Harry.
Crazy.
Harry.
So there you go. Full disclosure, listeners. This is going to be an unusual episode of The Talking Show, and it came together, let's be frank, in haste.
Yeah. Absolute last minute. We've never done it this way before.
So,
I mean, we run a really professional operation, and it's nerve-wracking during this sort of thing.
Doing the only thing he can do, right? Nicholas gets out the Talking Show Rolodex, starts flipping through it, making calls. Lorna's making calls. Solomon's making calls. I'm texting Henry back, being like, what the shit, dude? You asked to be on the show for years, and now, you know, this. Nothing. I still haven't gotten anything back from the guy, by the way. I've heard nothing from Hank. And
oh, my gosh. Do you see this Twitter post that Henry just made? Do you see this on Twitter? He's now gone to one of those ice cream shops where they have the long slab of marble behind the counter that's frozen, and you tell the guy or the girl what kind of ice cream you want, and they scoop it out onto the marble, and they flatten it with these tong things because touching it with their hands would be unhygienic. And then you tell what kind of toppings you want, and they put the toppings on this kind of flattened piece of ice cream, and then they're molding it over and over and over again into the perfect statistical distribution of topping and ice cream.
Yeah.
Topping and ice cream.
Yeah, incredible. Incredible. Anyway, so we finally found a guest, got in his car, drove all the way over here, last minute, possibly also the most intense man we could find who isn't Henry Rollins. It turns out that the guy who's actually free Wednesday night at midnight is actually someone maybe even more intense than Henry Rollins would have been, I guess, if that's your thing. So thanks for making it in. Thanks everyone at K-Chung for pulling together on this one and getting this show on the air. Our guest tonight is none other than German filmmaker Werner Herzog.
There is a couple of sources to it. Stroszek is actually the name of the leading character in my first long feature film in Signs of Life. And that had its root in an incident during some sort of fraudulent time at university. I had enrolled once for a very short time and never attended classes. And there was one guy whom I asked, write the paper for me, please. And he said, what do you give in return? And I said, I'm going to make your name immortal. And his name was Stroszek. So I used it twice. Second reason was that Bruno was in my previous film, Every Man for Himself and God Against All, or here known under the enigma of Caspar Hauser. And in this film, he was so extraordinary that I offered him to make another film. So we decided to do something else, and we decided to do Büchner's Wojciech, a drama fragment of Georg Büchner, the best playwright in German language, in my opinion, who died at the age of 23 only in the early 1820s. So finally I had some afterthoughts, and I said to Bruno, Bruno, I think it would be a massive mistake if you would be cast as Wojciech. I want to do it with Kinski. And it was very disappointing for him, and he had booked his vacations already and some unpaid weeks of vacation in addition. And he said to me, what am I going to do? And it was so embarrassing for me. It was so bad that I said to him, Bruno, we'll do another film. And he said, what is it going to be? And I said, Bruno, I'm going to write a screenplay quickly. By Saturday, you have it. And within 4 days, I wrote Stroszek, which is a film quite a bit oriented on his very life, on his real life. It was shot in his surrounding.
Denn der Bruno, der geht jetzt in Freiheit.
As you see here, this is a release from prison. Bruno has spent 23 years being locked away in institutions and in prisons and, of course, in his youth, in correctionals.
Yeah, and you're talking about in his real life. He was
in his real life, yes.
And how did you meet him?
I met him before I did The Enigma of Caspar Hauser. I was desperate. Who could play that part? There shouldn't be an actor. There should be someone more authentic than an actor, someone where we could believe our eyes again that there was someone for real. And I came across Bruno watching TV a few nights after I had finished the screenplay, and it was a film by a young film student, a Berlin film student, Lutz Eisholz, who had made a film on marginated people in Berlin, street singers.
What are we looking at?
That is actually a bottle of water. When the camera moves back, you will see that this is the television set, quote unquote, of prisoners. It's just a bottle filled with water and allows you to look at an angle down into the prison yard without climbing up to the window.
Let's get back to Bruno. So you saw him in this documentary.
Yeah. And I immediately had the feeling there was someone extraordinary. And I met a lot of resistance of my partners, and they didn't like the idea. They thought he couldn't be guided, he couldn't be managed. He was a difficult, wonderful man. And he's still around, obviously. But I had the feeling I had to defend my position and cast him anyway, because I was totally convinced he was someone whom we had not seen yet on a screen.
So he had no acting experience before
he met you. No acting experience whatsoever, and I think I was totally right to cast him.
And how difficult was he to work with?
Well, being locked away for so long, and the reason for it was that he was the illegitimate son of a prostitute who didn't want that child, kept beating the baby so bad that when he was 3 years old, he lost speech. He was talking already. And she put him away into an asylum for retarded and insane children, where he spent 6 years and then started to escape. Escaped, and was recaptured, and again in more severe institutions. And then he was released at age 26 from a lunatic asylum after 23 years of almost uninterrupted lockups. Here, those are some stories in prison. You see, at that time, Bonanza, the TV series, the American TV series, was very popular. And it also points out to the Turkish population in Berlin or in Germany in general. Berlin is the third largest Turkish city around. It's about 1 million or so Turkish people are living in Berlin alone.
In einem Beruf, der sehr, sehr viel Enttäuschungen und Bitterkeiten mit sich bringt.
The man here who plays prison ward is Alfred Edel, also a veteran of some of my films. I like him very, very much. Actually, not an actor either.
And where did you find him?
I found him through some films by Alexander Kluge, another German filmmaker of the early wave of new German films. And he had discovered that man, and I loved him very much.
Yeah. Bruno, darf ich ein sehr, sehr ernstes Wort mit Ihnen sagen?
And you see, there's something in Bruno that is very, very unusual in his expression of his eyes.
How much of what we're watching of Bruno is him acting, and how much is it of you catching his
personality? You see, now he's all of a sudden he's diving down. He was not supposed to do that. He just got rid of his accordion, I think. And now he goes on a tangent. He would talk like that, but he had to be encouraged to be himself. He would talk exactly like that when he was in private, but on camera he would be immediately different and would be intimidated by the presence of a camera. But now you see, he felt totally at ease. He was completely himself.
And what did you do to bring him to that state?
Well, that's my work. That's what I learned to do. Very hard to explain it. There was a mutual trust, a very deep trust into each other. And he knew I was going to do something which would end up like a monument for him, a monument for the unknown soldier of cinema. That's what I kept telling him. And he's the unknown soldier of cinema. He's only known by his first name, Bruno, and then S. Dot, because whenever there was a report in newspapers, in particular about juvenile delinquents, you couldn't give the name away. You just had it abbreviated, like Werner H. was arrested again, Bruno S. was arrested and charged, or Norm H. Was arrested in Seattle or whatever.
Wo du dich wieder so verausgabst. Ich will eines von dir, dass du nie mehr einen Tropfen Alkohol anrührst und ein zweites, dass du nie mehr ein Wirtshaus betrittst.
Großes ungarisches Ehrenwort.
And here this is a real prison actually in Berlin where we shot.
Were these scenes difficult for Bruno to film since he'd spent so many years in an institution?
Yes, he was kind of tense. There was some sort of apprehension, but he knew it was filming. And all the props you see, the bugelhorn, his accordion, that was all his prized possessions, all the things that he loved. And that's the bar at the corner where he used to live. First thing he enters the bar, of course that was scripted.
Herr Stäbiger, ein Bier.
And now it's very interesting who is going to come up. There are two pimps in discussion over a prostitute. Here you see Eva Mattis on the left. Burkhard Driest in The Man with the Back to Us is particularly dangerous. He called himself the Prince of Homburg, but he was a studio wrestler. He was one of those and a heavyweight boxer, always boxing guys far beyond his capabilities. And he was fighting Oscar Bonavina, an Argentinian heavyweight, ranking 3 in the world. And of course, in the 3rd or 4th round, he was very, very severely knocked out. And he became famous in a German sort of sports talk show. You see him now in the fur coat to the left here. The interviewer asked him, Mr. Gruppe, or shall I rather call you Prince? You were in the land of dreams 2 nights ago after your knockdown longer than ever before in your life. And the man who was ready to talk fell silent. And it went on and on and on, one question after the other in a live broadcast. And it became so dangerous. You saw how security was summoned in the background, and you knew one more question and he would kill the interviewer. It was one of the greatest moments I've ever seen on TV. Now the man in the middle, Burkhard Driest, he's a writer and a filmmaker and an actor, but he started out as a law student. Now, 2 weeks before his final exam, he commits a bank robbery. I'm speaking about realities. He committed a bank robbery, got away with the loot, hides it in the apartment of his girlfriend, who somehow had a fight with him a week later and gave him in. So he was sentenced to 5 years in prison, served 3.5, and while in prison became a writer and an actor. And Eva Mattis, one of the great German actresses, she played in quite a few of Fassbinder's films and many other German films. And she's the finest actress in theater in Germany. She's a very, very, very fine one. And here you see, those are dialogues I picked up from the prince, exactly as spoken here, exactly as spoken. He dragged me around with other pimps night after night, and showed me how, because he was so dangerous, other pimps would actually take him along to settle fights among themselves. He had a great sense of justice, by the way. He did it very well. And the man who is somehow harassed by them, you barely see him now at the left, he was a guy who was in trouble with the prince before, so he asked, can we have that guy, can we have Bernd in this here, yeah.
And did you always intend the role for Eva Mattis as well?
Yes, that was obvious. I really wanted her very bad for this part. She has something of real people. She doesn't look like a movie star. She has something which is very, very authentic. And you see, when women are crying on screen, it always somehow doesn't look good for me. I see it hardly good at all, and she does it very nice.
Wo kommst denn du her, Bruno?
Ich war auf Urlaub.
And how was her relationship with Bruno?
They got along very, very well. I think she immediately, as such an experienced actress, sensed there was an encounter with someone extraordinary. And she knew, she was briefed by me and she was enticed by me. to evoke things from him and trigger things and step beyond the lines of dialogue if necessary. So she needed to be very, very good in reacting and tickling things out of him. And he really was very, very good with Eva and vice versa. There was more problem with Herr Scheitz, the elderly man who will enter the movie in a moment. Because Scheitz, I mean, he was kind of a crazed man. And he thought that Bruno was smelling badly. And he didn't like that. This is actually Bruno's apartment. And he loves his instruments. There's a piano, which he actually bought from his fee as an actor in Kaspar Hauser, and always a big mess in his apartment. He would collect things like bugelhorns, all sorts of things.
Was he a street musician in real life?
Yes, that was. But he worked in a steel factory as a forklift driver. But on weekends, he would go out and do the things that he really loved, to sing in backyards, and we will see some of that later in the film. And how much he loves his piano. And I told him, just speak about your piano and play on it for the first time. And it doesn't matter that he's a dilettante. It's just wonderful how he never had a lesson in that. And, for example, he would collect from garbage old ventilators. And he had one functioning ventilator, and he discovered something very big. He painted the blades of the ventilator in the colors of the rainbow, spun the ventilator, and all of a sudden the colors disappeared and it was all white. And he said to me, Werner, you have to go and speak to the Academy of Sciences, the Bruno. He would always say, the Bruno, here, the Bruno. You can't translate it properly in English. He said, when the Bruno made this great discovery, can't you speak to the Academy of Science? So I said to Bruno, Bruno, this is known since a couple of centuries already, but but it is a wonderful and great, great, great discovery you made, because you made it all yourself, and you are like one of the great scientists in the world. And it's just a pity that you came later than the others. And he had such a sensitivity. He would do paintings himself, naive paintings, play music. I truly loved him for that.
And does he still do those things today?
Yes, he does. He's actually retired. He does not work as a forklift driver anymore. He's well over 65 by now. And now enters Herr Scheitz, whom I truly love a lot.
It was in Kaspar Hauser.
Yeah. And the bird, good boy, Bio. And Herr Scheitz, I found him in some sort of index cards for extras with a tiny little stamp-sized photo. And after going very quickly through 200, I stopped at his face and I said, that's the one I need and I want. And the agency told me, sorry, we represent our clients, but in our case, we have to warn you, he's not right in his head anymore. And he does talk strange things. Some of his Scheitz talk is actually in this film about his discoveries about mesmerism and animal magnetism and all sorts of things. And I liked him in Kaspar Hauser so much. I liked him so much that I asked him, stay on, I'll incorporate you in the next scene and in the next scene. At the end of shooting, I said to Herr Scheitz, you must have the last word in the film. And he said, what is it going to be? And I said, I don't know yet, but I'm writing some scene for you tomorrow. And he actually has the last scene in the film.
Shoot it, Eva.
Eva is this.
And you see, this bird really talks. It's no fake.
It's a Mima bird? Is that correct?
No, it's a starlet bird from Borneo. They are the best talkers in the world. This bird could ring like a telephone. That was the bird. You see, he could ring like a telephone and answer the phone himself, pretend to be the caller and answer. It was fantastic, but you would roll the camera for hours until he would do that. So. This is now Berlin, the area where Bruno would go out to do his backyard songs, his ballads. It's all 19th century sort of ballads, but actually it is a very ancient tradition of troubadour singers coming straight from the Middle Ages, which somehow filtered down into low proletarian street musicians.
Meine Damen und Herren, der Bruno wird auf dem Glockenspiel was durchgehen.
He says the Bruno, because the Bruno has the Eva with him. So it would sound odd in the subtitles to translate it that way. But this is exactly a situation that he would have every weekend. And this kind of stuff he loved more than anything else. And I said to Bruno, Bruno, you will have your songs in your film.
It adds a very rich element to the character.
Sure, yeah. There's something very, very authentic and very sweet about that and very vulnerable about him. This is one of the pre-war backyards of Berlin. It's a very, very strange tristesse about it, sadness about it. And now this was his favorite song. I just like it very much, and I said to Bruno, you must play that one. And normally would do that in one take. That was shot only once, and that was that.
We should talk about the shooting of this film. It's a little different from some of your other films. It's more handheld. Is that because you're going towards, since you're dealing with subject matter that's so close to reality?
Yeah. Well, the borderline between reality and fiction is very blurred, like in many of my documentaries anyway. But of course, it is a fictional film, and I try to be behind something that I tried all my life in the so-called documentaries. I try to scrutinize a deeper truth, something like, I call it an ecstatic truth, not accountant's truth of cinema vérité. And I've written a manifesto about truth and facts in movies.
Da machte ihr so. Wie konnt ihn keines geben? Denn keines war zu stellen.
And that is one of these quintessential scenes where there's great poetry in it, an ecstatic truth in this. I can't put it differently. How he comments his own song while he's singing. I just want to listen. I haven't heard it for a long time.
Da jagtet man mit Schimpf und Schattenverfiener aus dem Haus.
And he never had an accordion lesson in his life. And now something very strange happens. The child here to the left, the little boy who was supposed to leave, just leaned against the door and starts crying and doesn't follow the others. And I signal to the cameraman, don't stop, just don't cut.
Da komm her, komm.
Ja.
Da komm her, komm.
Na komm her, komm.
You see, it's not a voiceover, that's the very bird who talks there.
Danke, Ble.
Geige.
Violin, he says. Why? We'd never know. Yeah, and she tries to tidy up Bruno's place. That was always a problem of Bruno's life, that he couldn't cope with the physical world properly. He would overload himself with objects. And it's understandable because he always had so much lack of affection and so little context with human beings, so that he would put all his love into relationship with objects, pianos, things that he found in the garbage or wherever. Yeah, here are the two. Left the prince, right Burkhard Driest.
Did you have any problem approaching these guys for these roles?
No, I liked them, and they liked me back from minute one on. The Prince von Homburg took me around and showed me the deepest depths of his life. I mean, the real, real tough things at the Reeperbahn, which is a red light district in Hamburg, very famous. I mean, it's a tough world, and he was the toughest of them all. Many times in prison as well, he would try to pass a truck with his Ferrari, and the truck wouldn't let him pass, so he stopped the truck a couple of miles beyond that point and beat up the trucker so bad that he was hospitalized, so he got 4 months of prison term for that.
Eva, was machst du hier?
Die Seuche bricht aus, es stinkt.
Das werden wahrscheinlich die Hunde sein.
Hier sind aber keine Hunde.
Dann werden sie noch kommen, die Hunde.
Dann werde ich wahrscheinlich schon mal die Tür aufmachen müssen. Komm, Schnäckchen.
You see, he's one of those rather slender heavyweights with a very long reach, tall,
yeah, very
long
tall.
Reach. Very, very strong and very dangerous.
Ich grabe ihn dir vorne ein, den Zwerg.
In this dialogue, did you write this for them?
I gave him certain liberties.
Mit Lametta und Kugeln.
I would ask him, how would you insult her? How would you talk about this puny runt? What is...
Bitte, 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 bitte.
Please, please, pretty, please. That's his kind of lingo, and I loved this very much. And here Bruno with his fly open. In this case, it was a stylization, but quite often we would find him negligent about his outer appearance and... like here, for example, unkempt, and he didn't know how to adapt to bourgeois life or to well-settled life of prosperity, and he was always some sort of an outsider and somehow insisted in it. He didn't want to change. He said, Bruno is what he is, and the Bruno is what he is, and I said, Bruno, yes, that's fine, I respect that. And we don't make you into a Fred Astaire type in tuxedo and polished black shoes. And Herr Scheitz also plays the piano pretty well.
And what happened to Bruno after these films came out? They must have given him a lot of notoriety.
Yes, they did in Berlin, where he was very marginated. And they took him like a handicapped person in the big company where he worked. But, for example, before this film, when I called the office in Berlin and I asked, can I speak to Bruno? And the secretary would tell me, oh, I can't get him right on the phone. Our Bruno is on a transport in Hall C. And all of a sudden she spoke of our Bruno. So I noticed. Mm-hmm. Or, for example, the barber would give him a free haircut, drag him into the barber's shop and give him a haircut, and the pastry baker would give him a piece of tart. So people in this area really liked him, and the people who worked at this big factory, it had 4,000 people employed there, a steel factory. I think they all went to see Kaspar Hauser, and they were very proud of him, but essentially didn't change his life. I mean, so many years from so early on, being locked away does not somehow take away the catastrophe from him. He was still very much full of distrust, full of problems with his environment.
There are many stories of him having screaming tantrums and you having to take him aside to calm him down.
Yeah, I would let him do it and let him rave and rant. They were really brutal here with her. You see, it's... And Eva said, just do it as you would normally do it. And you see, she's a very, very good actress, but she would take anything for making it powerful and believable. But whenever Bruno had any of his moments, or sometimes I would drag out for 2, 3, 4 hours, I asked the whole crew, stay where you are, make eye contact, listen. And I realized, because a sound guy all of a sudden after half an hour started to thumb through a magazine, and I said to him, this must not happen again. You are being paid for being here, and the real necessity is that all of us, we have to listen to Bruno. That's what we are here for now. We are not for recording sound. We need to listen to Bruno. And Bruno, of course, sensed that all of a sudden everyone on the set was focused on him and listened with sympathy. And that brought him back in line, and he said, the Bruno has talked too much. Let's go and let's do it quickly, and let's do some good work now. And he was fully back into shooting the film.
There is not one sequence in this film that I can think of that he ever steps out of character.
No, he is himself, and he is... he has something magnificent about him. The magnificent of someone who has been beaten too much and has been tortured and has gone through a veritable catastrophe in his life that nothing and no one on this earth will ever take away and extinguish and remedy.
But interestingly enough, he doesn't turn out like the boxer. He doesn't vent violence with violence. It seems
no,
he's
not at
more
all.
Internalized.
It's a very, very sweet, sweet soul.
My name's Sean.
See,
just listen to his voice.
Eva, nimm doch. Ein Schluck wenigstens.
He has such a sweetness in him. And it was systematically trampled upon and extinguished throughout his life.
And this, of course, becomes the sequence that convinces Bruno that they need to leave.
Yeah, sure.
Could you talk a little bit about your feelings about America and why you incorporated that theme into the script?
Well, I have been in America from off and on, but the first time age 23. And much what I saw in Pittsburgh in Pennsylvania and later also in Wisconsin is a reflection of what I have seen and what I experienced. And I like it. I like the country. I like America, but in some sort of an ambivalent way, and you can tell. And here this is a scene which is mostly improvised by the guy on the left, the Prince of Homburg. There was no clear dialogue. I only wanted him to make a reference to the Muslim quarters where Bruno lived, to the Turks. And they were quite drunk. This bottle was the second bottle they had swigged down.
And so basically, as director, you just stand back and watch and see what they come up with.
No, it was hard to watch because it is so painful. Mm-hmm. And it pains me to see it until this very day. Of course, Bruno knew what was going to happen, and we all knew and had to face it that this was a performance. But just watching it makes me silent to see that.
Du wohnst doch hier in der Türkengegend, oder nicht? Antwort hier.
Ja.
Laut?
Ja!
Bravo! Halt die Mühe so, ja, ganz gerade, vorsichtig. So. Bist du denn noch zu retten, du alter Kabitz? Das Wichtigste. So. Dass du hier ja so liegen bleibst, hast du das gehört?
Ja. ich hab gehört.
Laut! Ja!
Bravo.
What would happen to Bruno after scenes like that?
Oh, he took it easily because he said, I'm going to be a good soldier. And, of course, I know that we have to go through a scene like that. And it doesn't really hurt that much because I was hurt much, much badder. I was beaten up and I was hurt and I had to hold my wet bed sheets that I had urinated into all day long in front of the other children until it was dry. And this is a real doctor at the ward for the prematurely born. He speaks with an accent because he's Czech born. And I liked him very, very much. And I had long discussions with him at the premature ward because I was so fascinated about this kind of apish grip reflex, this incredible power of prematurely born children who would hang on a clothesline by themselves if you hang them onto it. We had some talks and I said to Bruno, something like that I would like to have in the film as well, even though the film doesn't call for it, but the feeling for humanity and for dignity and the mystery of what we are needs to be in this film here. And in a moment like that, I want you to visit the doctor who normally would go to the prison and look after you.
Kommen Sie mit auf die Frühgeborenenstation. Ich möchte Ihnen etwas zeigen.
And now he wants to show him something, yeah. That is a child born 7 months premature one.
This is by far, to me, one of the most disturbing scenes in the film, but it's also one of the most touching. Yeah.
And he was actually the doctor in this ward, and he knew how to handle them. See, he doesn't hold the child, it hangs on his index fingers. It's such a mysterious and strange scene.
And the child's not being hurt at all.
Oh, no, absolutely not. And he knows how to handle it, how to hold the little one. And they actually love to be touched and stroked and,
we see that
and
right
manipulated,
here.
Yes, yeah. See, he just whispers to his ear
and he's absolutely blows
at his ear, yeah. No, he's a very, very fine man. Unfortunately, he died. I liked him a lot. You see, that's a kind of physician I would like to have for my children, to entrust him everything. That's a man. It's a very mysterious world of the prematurely born.
So let's go back to the topic of America, because they're about to take this voyage. Did you incorporate this in the screenplay, because Bruno had always wanted to go to America?
No, that was screenplay. But of course, Bruno had never gotten around. He was never anywhere around. For the first time for doing the film Kaspar Hauser, he was in the south of Germany, for example. He was very curious, and he was very excited to see some of the country. And he liked to be there. He liked the kind of pragmatic people who would be, and in particular in the Midwest, which I consider the best part of America.
Why is that?
People are very kind, very big hearts, down to earth, hardworking, no bullshit, nothing like Hollywood, nothing like the craze in New York or whatever. Good people, solidly on the ground, generous. Everything that's good about America you'd find in the Midwest, and always the very best come from there. Hemingway from Kansas, Marlon Brando from also the Midwest somewhere, Bob Dylan from Minnesota. That's where the good ones come from.
Do you think that part of you related to this concept of going to a foreign country, because you yourself sort of grew up in a more isolated area of Germany?
Yeah, but it's different because America is so open. The center of America is a vast, everything is vast and strange and open. Where I grew up was remote but totally enclosed, a narrow valley that ended up in a cul-de-sac and mountains all around. So it was a different sort of America.
But that's something that you definitely see in this film, because the scenes in Germany are much more claustrophobic than when you go into the American countryside. Yeah.
And of course, once we get there, we have to talk about this specific American countryside, because as there is such a thing like John Ford country in Monument Valley, there is such a thing like Errol Morris country. There's a big story behind it, and Errol was very, very upset for quite a while that I went there and shot something there, which was his terrain. Here you see they are Turkish people who barely speak German. That's why some of their dialogue, which is in Turkish later on, is not translated. I don't know what they spoke until this very day.
And is this a very common scene in some areas of Germany?
Yeah, prostitutes, cheap prostitutes would go to their working quarters, to the mobile homes that they had at construction sites and do their job with them. Here they spoke Turkish, and I don't know what they said, which is okay.
So, Bruno, was sagst du jetzt? Das habe ich alles verdient.
Ich falle offen ran.
Das reicht fürs Erste. Jetzt fangen wir ganz neu an.
Wirklich? Und es wird auch Zeit, dass der Bruno von Berlin verschwindet. Denn das geht mal sowieso auf den Geist.
Bruno, ich habe gute Nachrichten von meinem Neffen. Er schreibt mir, dass sie in seiner Autoreparaturwerkstatt.
Here's the catalyst to send them to America.
Yeah.
That he has the nephew. I like this sequence because it's almost as if they're dreaming of America.
Yeah. Sure, yes.
The waitress and the auto repair, it sounds so fantastic.
Yeah. And I think this is the dream not only of Bruno, that is the dream of the immigrants. You start low as a waitress, but if you work hard, if you do it well, if you have a perspective and a vision, you can make it big. And that's the great thing about America, that it actually allows you, takes you by your own value.
And now we come to New York.
Yes, that was shot from the Empire State Building. You can see the shadow, and by coincidence, a passenger ship arrived, and we took advantage of that. Everything you see from here on, the five or six following sequences or scenes, little scenes, were all shot in one single day of shooting. We had no permit, but we disassembled the camera, took the lenses away, the magazine, carried it in small little bags, put it together and filmed that thing. This was shot just in the street, dodging some police, which was around.
And basically you're looking for sequences to tell us that they've come to this country?
Sure, and it's the, of course, it is a situation where they come by boat, which is the classical sort of immigration. Here, taxi, George Washington Bridge, I guess.
They even bring the
bird. Yeah, but it was confiscated.
Oh.
Yeah. Look at the dialogue, yeah. And that is bureaucracy. They are tough when it comes to bringing in a live bird or a live plant or some seeds. So those were things done very, very quickly with a very small crew. I mean, the entire crew in this film was something like 12 people or so. I mean, on locations, now Empire State Building.
And your main cinematographer was Thomas Mauch.
Thomas Mauch, yeah, all done within 5 minutes or so, quickly before they threw us out.
So you two have a very good relationship since you've worked on several feature films. Yeah. How do you express your ideas to him to get them across when you're shooting so quickly?
Well, in this case, it was very easy, but I have to say something about that film which may sound completely unbelievable for anyone. The climate, the atmosphere during shooting of this film was very bad. All the crew, without hardly any exception, hated the story, hated the film, hated Bruno, hated Scheitz. Just, it was very, very hard to maintain the dignity of Bruno, maintain the dignity of the story and keep it out of all this. But sometimes that happened, it's inexplicable. Inexplicable, because the mood during shooting was always very, very good. That is still the same day of shooting. We were arrested 3 times within an hour because we were hanging on to the hood. We didn't have a vehicle that would tow this. Thomas Mauch and I were just strapped with some belts to the hood and we're filming it. Of course, that was something the cops didn't like at all. And I was handcuffed that day 2 times. And I think stopped 3 times, and we always got away. I said, "Ah, oh, yeah, we are." You know, we looked very young at that time, and I said, "We are these crazy crowds, these film students," and and so the cops let us get away with it. And the same one caught us 30 minutes later. We were still at it.
And is this Chet Atkins that we're listening
yes.
to?
Yes, I mean it's some sort of music where you would never ever guess that I would use a music like that in any of my films, but it's wonderful here. It has this kind of cheap dream of America and this cheap emotionality, and it fits really well. I love Chet Atkins for that music.
Wow.
Yeah, wow.
Yeah. What do you make of that?
Well, Nicholas? After I peel myself off of my chair from the intensity of it, I'll then have a second to think.
You know, I think there's something really special about the way Werner talks, don't you?
Yeah. He speaks intensely.
Yeah. I like the combination of sort of a Midwestern accent and a German accent blending together. I think it's a kind of hybrid form of English.
Yeah, it's not like a spaghetti Western. It's like a sauerkraut Western. Or like a Frankfurter Western. You know, like Frankfurters from Frankfurt, the German city.
We see a lot. We hear it a lot in our day-to-day life. We hear people speaking so Californian surfer dude mixed with Spanish or what, all kinds of varieties of this stuff. And the texture has this foreign quality, yet at the same time, an immense familiarity.
Yeah, I agree. His way of speaking is inimitable.
Yeah, no one else quite expresses themselves the same way, that's for sure.
Yeah, I think what Steve is trying to say is that as you accumulate experience, this somehow gets embedded into your voice. And as we kind of disperse as a society, our voices have become more complex.
Yeah.
Much more. Almost as complex as a character in a Herzog movie.
I know. And it's incredible his ability to find these people too. These people to put in movies and the stories that he can tell about them independently of the story he tells about them as characters in a movie. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, anyway, I see here that Henry Rollins is appropriately upset, I guess, that we gave his spot to Werner Herzog. However, I mean, really, it's his own fault. We've been very upfront with him about the scheduling situation this entire time. I think that maybe if we can work it out, if Henry, you know, gives us a gift basket or something like that, we will work it out where he can eventually be on air with us again in sometime in the future. But in the meantime, let's have a big round of applause for Werner Herzog showing up at the last minute, saving the show for this Wednesday.
Yeah, I'd even say conquered the show. He conquered the show this Wednesday. Conquered.
And a big round of applause for the staff here at K-Chung for panicking, working it out, overcoming this adversity. You know, really, really good effort today, everyone.
Yeah.
Yeah.
High pass.
All right. Well, that's the end of another show. Good night, everyone.
See you next time. Good night.